We're back to the Neil Haley Show here on the Caregiver Dave Celebrity segment. I'm excited to welcome the program, Caregiver Dave Nisani. Dave, how are you? 2 days to the new year. Can you believe it? 2021 is about to say sayonara. It's been a crazy year. And I just think it's been better than 2020. So I'll take it. You know what 2020 was to 2021 and where 2022 is. So Dave,
just a bad dream, but not a nightmare, right?
Are you building your New Year's resolutions right now? Are you putting those together?
I always have my New Year's resolutions right on the tip of my tongue. Yes, I'm going to speak at the White House. I'm going to speak at Congress. Just a whole bunch of good stuff.
And you make sure you have it. And that's the thing. And that's exciting. And I'm excited about our guest. It's interesting. I'm a little jealous. He's in Brazil right now filming. And that's he just finished filming in Africa. And I'm excited to welcome him, Samuel K. Forrest of Hip Beat. He's a film director and actor. And he also, I was really interested in this thing. He was part of Street Survivors, the true story of the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash. Samuel, thanks for stopping by. How are you, man?
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And it's it's lovely to be here. And it is an interesting, I was listening to you guys talking about how it's the end of the year and it's a little bit like deja vu, but hopefully we've all learned a little bit more and end the new year strong. So yeah, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Especially if you're not in London where, you know, lockdown's going more and more in the United States, it depends where you're at and everything.
Exactly.
And I don't even want to mention COVID because COVID's just part of life. So let's talk
about
you always want to become a filmmaker. Is that something growing up you wanted to do?
I think it was kind of in my blood. But as you know, I grew up with, when you grow up with family who are like struggling artists or in the film business, you kind of see the realities of it. So you definitely avoid that world for a while. And then eventually, I guess the acting bug kind of just took a hold of me. And my mom was always very adamant, if you want to do acting, you got to do Shakespeare and theater and, you know, read and all this stuff. So I got into doing theater when I was quite young. And so, and then that naturally progressed into making films. It's actually an interesting story because I was doing a play. I was acting in a play in London. And my friend who was the director on the show got really sick 2 weeks beforehand. So I had never planned on directing, but he knew I was good with actors. So he's like, why don't you step in for me when we lead up to dress rehearsal and into the show starts? And the creative director saw me directing. And he's like, oh, you're really quite good at this. Would you like to direct a play in the future? And so it was quite unplanned to become a filmmaker myself. I always thought it was quite daunting. And then I was shooting a film in India where I was helping on someone else's project. And the director just kind of had a meltdown. So I had to kind of pull it together and end up helping finish the shoot. And so after those two experiences, I kind of realized that like there was a lot of passion and I could kind of see that was part of my best self would come out, bringing people together, giving them the freedom and to express themselves, but also the trust that was important. But then coming from an actor's family and background, I understood how actors can be emotionally naked. So it was very easy to communicate with them. And that led me to like naturally falling in love with storytelling and how to kind of bring all the pieces together, so to speak.
Wow, so it was an unusual progression. So how many films did you act in before you started doing that?
Well, I had done mostly theater, so a lot of theater coming from England, that's kind of the route you go. And then I had acted in about 4 films before I realized, okay, I kind of understand how the ins and outs work of this. And one in San Francisco, one in New York, and then of course Street Survivors, which was a very interesting experience because you're playing a real person, which was Steve Gaines, and rest in peace, who was a great guitarist and kind of virtuoso who died too young, was one of the with Ronnie Van Zant was one, and his sister actually, which is Cassie, which is quite tragic. They all died in the plane crash that happened, which everyone knows. And so it was quite there was this responsibility to understand the person and to kind of really understand like what was his passions, his motivations, and kind of what made him feel alive. And so that was really kind of an honor. And also to learn the music was a lot of fun. And then I did a film in the UK, and then like I said, in India. So an all independent stuff, but it all definitely taught me how to kind of deliver, but also to follow through and kind of the ins and outs in front of the camera and behind the camera. So after those experiences, you start to pick up little wisdom and knowledges and you're like, okay, I understand how the ins and outs work. And then I went off and wrote the script in the film that we're talking about, Hit Beat, which is the one in Berlin. After acting in those films, I had this idea where I was completely inspired by the city of Berlin and its nightlife and its kind of counterculture. that I started writing that script, and I found the right window in 2018 to develop it. And then 2019, we mostly shot it, and a little in 2018, but mostly 2019, and got very lucky because the film is, you know, a lot of clubs and partying and wild nightlife and intimacy and, you know, the rave world, which I knew I wouldn't have been able to shoot now, for example. So
exactly. I feel like you jumped on at the right time. We'll go into the yeah. film a little later. I wanted to kind of talk about the role of learning the music of Lynyrd Skynyrd. Were you familiar with the music before that?
Yeah. I had heard the music before. I mean, there's some classic songs on there, but we had to feel like during the band process, we had to learn how to, you know, to be realistic, you know, and these are great songs. And so I think they did it when they were casting, everyone could play their instruments, I think, except for one or two of us. So I had had a place in LA I was living where we had a home studio. And so, because I live with all these musicians, and so we just go in and do rehearsals, which it was a great experience because some of the players, the existing players would come over while we were rehearsing, which was quite surreal, you know, to be rehearsing with some of the guys from the original band. And so that was kind of beautiful. So we'd have rehearsals and we just kind of would learn all the songs as much as possible. And I think only parts of it ended up in the film, but it was a great process of camaraderie and to kind of get to feel like we were a family with the other guys who were the band members. And so that was a great way to kind of have to learn the music together.
Wow. I bet your parents are very proud.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, to be honest, I don't even know if they've seen it, but they're amazing and very supportive. You know, they've always kind of been there, but also taught me the reality of what this world is like. You know,
so you're talking. I want to jump back into that family atmosphere. You were in the industry of entertainment growing up. How was that being able to see that? Because I could see that my children, if they start to look at specifically acting or performing or different things, they're going to really see, well, I saw, you know, dad doing TV. I saw dad even back in the days when he was a professional wrestler. Later on, when they start to understand who I was then mm-hmm. to who I am today, and they feel comfortable and they say, oh, I want to take after that person and do that. You were exposed to it. Like, what kind? Is it more theater they were doing, or do they do films as well?
It was all. It was a bit of both. I mean, it was kind of in the blood, so to speak, because my grandmother was an actress in Europe, and my grandfather was, and then there was a kind of a long lineage of actors and lesbians, and so it was something that definitely growing up with that reality and that struggle definitely makes you want to not do that for a while, you know. But you kind of are raised in this environment that is quite open to explore and to question things. And so that was, I was always grateful for, but they were also very adamant that if you want to do this, you have to do it seriously. And, you know, my mom used to read me a lot of theater and Shakespeare, and she was an actress, and my dad did acting and was in a couple of interesting things back in the day, like the original Star Wars and film Reds and like Nikita and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
And so he had been.
What was he in the original Star Wars? How was he?
He was in a role called The Fixer, which they had actually cut out of their last cut, but I think it's in the extended version now. But it's quite I didn't at the time, he never thought it'd be a big thing, but you know, Star Wars conventions are huge. So he's that you know, when Alec Guinness kind of goes in and he tries to wipe the memory of that stormtrooper, and he's like that one stormtrooper in the movie who speaks.
Yes.
So that's my dad. So it kind of became this thing that we kind of became like a famous line, I suppose. And it was really funny because originally he had a bigger role and they cut it out of the film. And I guess George Lucas was like, well, we also need people to play stormtroopers. Do you want to play this stormtrooper? And so then cut to 20 years later, when we were struggling at times, it was like this weird blessing for him, because when we were like, couldn't have food on the table, sometimes he would found out that like, oh, this is an important thing to people. And so he was able to like kind of go around to all these Comic Cons and like find out there was a huge support behind all the Star Wars characters, which is something he had no clue about until, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so it was this weird thing where it kind of had been helping our family for decades without really knowing. And then he'd just been around it though. I think he had spent a lot of time with, and then he got into music producing in London. So he'd been around the ins and outs of people of all status and all levels of creativity and then became kind of a struggling writer. And then my mother was an actress who, you know, became a teacher and a drama therapist. So it was always a world where I could challenge myself and explore, but it was also a reality where I grew up completely what the reality was like, you know? And so that was very eye-opening, but also at times you were like, oh, I don't know if I want to do that. You know, I see the struggle. But in the long run, I guess you can't escape your fate in some way. And the passion just overwhelmed me once I really dove into it. But it also taught me, if you really want to create, you have to collaborate with other people, serve their story. But it also taught me to kind of write yourself or to tell your story. So I'm a big encourager of people telling their story and trying to get them, because the biggest way to kind of get that, I get it out there, or to express or to learn, which I think is the most important, is to some way tell your story in whatever medium or whatever way that is, or whatever way you want to communicate it. And so I learned through their struggle, it's better not to wait on people, you know, because if you wait too much, sometimes maybe you'll just keep waiting, expecting.
Exactly.
Better to
Davey, there still?
You know?
Yeah.
Sorry if I keep rambling, but
no, that's awesome. And so, Dave, I wanted to go back to you for a second. I want to say the story is, it's very interesting that family members and how they're involved in specific things. I talked to Steve Tormé last week, Mel Tormé's son, and Mel Tormé is famous singer. And Steve ended up being his stepdad. Steve March was his biggest influence, because he didn't see his dad till later, but his talent came out from Mel. Isn't that interesting, Dave? That's the interesting thing, is your bloodline, at times you might not know, if you know, if you didn't spend as much time with that person, that characteristic comes alive.
It's definitely, I definitely think so. I mean, it's just also a lot of times with creativity, I think it's been given the permission, you know. And that's why I think film school or theater school or any creative outlet or any expression or communication is big part of it, has been giving the permission to do that. And so I'm very grateful they did give me that permission to kind of explore that was. And people do think you're a little bit far-fetched or it's not realistic, you know, but then once you start to find your footing, it's a little bit easier to inspire people and have them trust you and to actually, you know, create together. So
you actually remind me of Drew Barrymore and her famous family of Barrymores, you know.
Yeah.
So were your parents kind of shocked that not only could you act, but you know, write, direct, and especially the writing? I mean, did they do any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're a little bit surprised, because when I was younger, I was like so opposite wanting to do that. You know, I think it was like growing up with that reality of struggle, you're like, yeah, that world is, you know, that it's fun as it is, it's a very unpredictable world. And but then I think they saw that when I did it, I'm very tenacious. So I kind of really dove right into it. And through theater and through all these things, I really started to learn and grow and to really, really fall in love with it. But they were also very quick to give me the reality of what this was. But it was only, to be honest, it was only till recently that they started to kind of take it a lot more seriously. Because I think it's like, once you say you're going to write this and go halfway across the world and do it, people are like, okay, yeah, you're mad, you know, what are you talking about? And then once you start to go through the first and then the second one, and then you're working on the third, like, okay, maybe he doesn't know what he's doing. He's not a complete, you know, madman. And so now they've become more accepting of it, but they were definitely quite frightened. And at times I'm sure they are a little bit daunted when I'm like, okay, I'll talk to you in, you know, 4 weeks, I'm going to West Africa. They're like, what? I was like, I'm going to be gone here for a while. And I think now they've kind of just think, well, that's Sam, you know, that's, you know, it's just they're kind of understanding of it. But it definitely took a while before they were very accepting of it in some way. But they understood the process of it. But I definitely had to, you know, to kind of just lead with my actions, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense. So
I was the same way. You know, I come from a gas station family, and I did everything to get out of it because I hated it.
Yeah.
And I came back, and now I'm you know, gasolineexpert.com, and I'm making television appearances about the gas industry, et cetera. So
Well, that's amazing. That's the thing. We all are on our hero's journey, so to speak, and you kind of learn. And that goes back to the film, which is, the film for me was a big thing about, you know, the outsiders, the people who want to leave their comfort zone and to get away from the kind of, you know, the norms of maybe where they grew up, and were curious enough to kind of challenge the status quo and leave that comfort zone. So that reminds me a lot of what Hip Peak deals with, is like the outsiders, which is a big thing in Berlin, is there are a lot of people searching for things, but also did they had one thing that was kind of universal, is that everyone was kind of from somewhere else. But I think New York's like that, or maybe even Pittsburgh or LA. There's a lot of cities, major cities, where people do have this assimilation where they come from a different place and they're searching for something, you know? So I can understand that, you know?
So tell me a little bit, Samuel, how that project came about. You're the filmmaker for this, right? This is your project, right? Your baby.
Hit beat.
Yeah.
It was the catalyst of it was I visited my siblings who helped, you know, work on the project as well. Kind of a, you know, family unit thing at times. Who are also creatives. One's a dancer and the other one's a musician. What we had done is that when I had visited them, I saw this great, the rave scene, the nightlife, the club scene, the art, the creative scene was so fascinating and interesting and challenging and inclusive that I thought was very inspired by this kind of all corners of the world kind of coming together and this kind of experience of kind of not only unity, but also just like celebration of love. And so I was like, I had never quite seen, I'd seen that in LA, in different cities around the world, but in that way of where like being strange or a little outsider or kind of weirder, the better is more celebrated there in some way. And I thought that was such a great catalyst of seeing my sibling's story and kind of writing it based around that and kind of that world. And so I visited there and then I was inspired after I'd shot this film in India. I was like, I have to go there. And I started writing the script and I absorbed the world for about 6 to 8 months while developing everything. And kind of really like lived and immersed myself in the rave scene, the club scene, the queer scene, the activist scene, the nightlife, and it was a kind of amalgamation during the writing process of also meeting people, whether it was like in a theater show, a live performance, anywhere. And then I would kind of feel like, oh, that's the right spirit for this role, or that's right this. But having my siblings already involved in the community was very easy access to a world that is so exclusive. Like people are very hesitant about opening up the things that are very personal to them. And so there was a big responsibility to make the film with the community. I didn't want it to feel like, oh, we're these outsiders or people who don't understand or aren't assimilating or going through the same things where we're coming in and making this film. We wanted to make it a collective thing where we cast a lot of the extras or small roles from people we met in the rave community or in the activist community. And to just not only for authentic purposes, but also to make people feel like they could trust us because we were given access to some of the most exclusive clubs in the world.
Wow. Awesome.
So is it?
Yeah. So, and one thing to add about that, Samuel, so you talked about the rave scene. So it's a lot of EDM then, right? In Berlin.
Yeah. There are some, it's definitely EDM. There's the rave scene, which is all genres of music, but it is a nightlife. I mean, the film takes span over 120 hours. So it's, you know, that was the longest club that would stay open in Berlin. So I thought it was an interesting kind of parallel to like, what's the longest club and how much can you do in this time frame when I was writing the script? How much can you do in the span of how long the longest club in Berlin stays open for? And it was 120 hours, five days.
Gosh.
Yeah, most are about 48 to 72 hours where they're consistent. They're open the entire time, which I think is, you know, and all kudos to people who can do that. But, you know, I could never do that. But, it was something where I was like, that's an interesting way to piece the time frame where it's in that short window of what you can do in essentially less than a week, which is how long the club was. Because when I was writing the script, we'd go around and meet all these people and I'd absorb the world, and I kind of realized like these people do a lot in a short period of time. Like I had met people who would go to a protest in the day and then they would rave at night and then they would go hang out with their friends and then they would be with their girlfriend or their boyfriend or like, and or then they would be at the park or then they would go to work or then there are all these things that would happen in a short window of time, which I thought was a really interesting thing to kind of deal with narratively. And so it was something where the inspiration was just overwhelming. So I was like, I'd never seen a world where the nightlife had blended so much with just everyday life, if that makes sense, like nurses and lawyers, doctors, teachers, like airline pilots, all these people would be in the rave scene because it was like their way of like venting in a way. So it's not like in most cities, like, you know, I spent a lot of time in LA and London where, you know, there's a separation of maybe certain people who hang out in certain scenes. Everyone would kind of collided. So I thought that was really fascinating to kind of see people kind of overlap in this nightlife in this world that was so open, when it was this freedom that people could literally just go there and do whatever they want as long as they respected somebody's space, you know, and didn't like overstep their boundaries in a physical or like in a, you know, in a very threatening way, you know.
That's so interesting. So Dave, your final question is always a caregiving question. Go ahead and ask that to Sam.
Yeah. So as I said, I'm in the gas station business and all of a sudden I become a caregiver overnight. Now I'm writing books. I'm traveling all over the country, speaking on television and speaking on stages. And now they're making a film about my life. Apparently they think my life is interesting enough. They're going to be getting a rough cut out in a couple of months here. So I have no idea where I'm going, but fate and destiny is kind of leading the way. But my message is that, you know, being a caregiver, I made a lot of mistakes and I discovered that I almost burned out. 30% of caregivers actually die before their loved ones do. The rest of them are hospitalized and need a caregiver. So, I mean, have you ever thought about this prospect that your parents one day might need care and you may have to put everything on hold to be their caregiver?
Yes, of course. I mean, one, thank you, because it's much more noble what you're doing than necessarily making films. It's, you know, so thank you
for what you're doing,
especially in these times, you know, and it's really noble. And I think about it a lot, actually. You know, I think a lot of times we take for granted, you know, growing older is a beautiful thing, but also how society treats it and how youth take it for granted, you know. And I think hopefully the pandemic has reawoken these questions and made people really understand looking at things, you know, to be not only to be grateful, but to understand what needs to change, you know, and to be aware of these things moving forward and to learn from the mistakes. And, you know, being a caregiver is, you know, a healer, someone who's very selfless. So that's amazing. And I do think about these things a lot with my family, you know, especially my dad's much older than my mom, you know, and you know, how age is. And I also think about how we look at, you know, dealing with a lot of people who are elderly or dealing with a lot of people who need care. And how what needs to change to make it not only more accessible, but more comfortable, but also to bring a voice to this. You know, it's something that it does weigh on my mind a lot. And my parents, you know, I think it's definitely something where you want them to have their own independence and freedom and support them where they can and what they're doing. And that luckily they still have each other, you know, but it is something I do talk to my mom a lot about because my dad is much older and, you know, he has some health problems and stuff. Yeah. And so it's important to bring these questions and this awareness to, you know, because I think a lot of times in the US, the UK, or even Europe, we tend to just try and discard it and not want to deal with it. But mortality is part of life, you know, and how we deal with these things and also addressing that through your actions and what you're going through and giving these speeches is extremely important to help you bring that awareness, like I said, but also to start making policy or actual changes of how we distribute money to it, but also how do we address, you know, it's an interesting thing when you're you know, in society, because, you know, and not to go on a tangent, but I find the youth is, you know, naive and doesn't know what it's talking about. And the elderly who have the most wisdom are usually told to shut up and to be discarded. Yeah. So it's like this weird thing where I think we can learn from everything, especially the people who've gone through so many things. So I think taking a breath and listening to each other, and I'm sure you hear some pretty compelling, moving stories about people who have so much wisdom to share. So it's nice that you're vocalizing that and then expressing it to other people. It's really powerful.
And I'm releasing my fourth book on wisdom called Secrets from the Hammock, Uncommon Wisdom for Uncommon Times. That's coming out February 4th. So the That's website amazing. CaregiverDave.com. Excited about
I look forward to reading. That's amazing. And, great. It's amazing what you're doing. Yeah, yeah.
Make sure you get a copy.
Thank you. And congrats on them making it into a story. And a film.
Go figure.
You know, it's amazing.
As Samuel talked about before, you never know when those opportunities come. And don't be afraid for them to knock. And we're going into that time. Where can people check out HipBeat? Where's the best place?
It's on Amazon, Amazon Rentals, Amazon Prime. It's going to be next month, but it's on Amazon at the moment. YouTube Rentals, Google Play, and it will be on Tico, which is a section of Amazon, a queer streaming service, early next month. And then it will also be on Apple in Europe in the spring. But Amazon, YouTube, Google Play at the moment.
All right. We appreciate it, Samuel. Good luck with all your ventures and all that stuff. And thanks again, Dave, and appreciate you both.
Yeah, thank you. And stay safe out there and happy holidays. Enjoy New Year, New Year's.
All right. You too.
And we happy appreciate New Year, you, everybody. Neil.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Neil.
All right. Take care, guys. Happy New Year. All right. Okay, guys. That was the Caregiver Dave celebrity segment. Take care.